Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest tonight is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, CORBETTREPORT.com. James has been living and working in Japan for the past 10 years, started the Corbett Report 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's also editorial writer for the International Forecaster weekly e-newsletter created by the recently deceased economic analysis analyst Bob Chapman. Hello, James. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty good. How are things on your side of the pond?
You know, sometimes I'm the last one to know. You can't help but wonder. And in fact, I was talking about it in the first part of the program. Insofar as we can't trust government to tell us the truth of what's happening, we're increasingly put in a point where we really do have to engage in independent analysis to perceive where we are. I've told people about an article I saw several years ago where we look back at the Great Depression and people say, well, it began in 1929 with a stock market crash. But I saw a report that where they said, in fact, there was no general consensus that we even were in a depression until about 1933. We were 4 years into the depression before everybody agreed, yeah, we're in a depression.
Yeah, and that's so, exactly right.
So where are we today? And if you can't trust the government, who can you trust? How can you know where we are? And again, this is a requirement for that independent perception. Sounds a little bit like your Corbett Report.
Well, I certainly hope so, because I think you hit the nail on the head. We can't trust the pronouncements of a government that, I mean, at the very least, is motivated by its own self-interest to lie to the public in ways that are convenient. And we see that, for example, this week with the Federal Reserve now coming out and saying, look, employment is going tickety-boo, everyone's getting jobs, so we're going to continue our cutback of QE3 and end it all, and we're going to start raising interest rates next year. Well, I think there's a lot of things that are wrong with that assessment, namely, of course, the idea that employment is fine and everyone's happy, as we've talked about on this program before, and as I'm sure you and Melody have covered many times. This is, I mean, just a complete misreading of the employment situation in the U.S. right now, which is clearly, I'm sure most of your listeners know from their own personal experience, but I mean, we can also look at the statistics to see how clearly manipulated the employment stats are, to the point where it's not only the plunging labor participation rate, which gives us a real insight into who is actually employed, rather than using these made-up phony government ideas of what employed means, but also the fact that even the people who are employed tend to be vastly underemployed, either in part-time work, contract work, temporary work, work that is not the full-time gainful employment that people want, let alone the type of employment that people had 30, 40, 50 years ago, where you could join a company and work your entire life and get a pension. Those days are gone, and that security is gone, and it is changing the fabric of society. I mean, there is a reason why so many young people these days tend not to get married, and if they do, they get married much later, and tend not to start families, and if they do, they start families much later. It's not necessarily because of a moral change so much as an economic one, and I've experienced that in my own life. I'm now 35 and only newly a father myself, which, I mean, just a generation ago would have seemed like an unusual situation for a lot of people, but again, it's just difficult.
In other words, a generation ago, that would be late.
Exactly. My parents, of course, were in their early 20s when they got married and started having babies, and that would have been much more common back then, but now that would seem very early to today's generation.
I understand. You know, you mentioned government changing the definitions of unemployment and the formulas they use to calculate unemployment rates in order to generate false confidence in the American people. I was listening to Marshall McLuhan, an interview by Marshall McLuhan from back in the 1960s. He was talking to Norman Mailer, and he made the point, do you know what the original definition of reading was?
I can't say that I do, no.
He said it was to guess. And when I first heard that, I thought, what are you talking to guess? What's that got to do with reading? He said, he went on to explain, it's because every word has, or virtually every word, has multiple definitions and possible meanings. You get a decent dictionary, you're hard-pressed to find a word in the dictionary that has a single meaning. Almost all of them have multiple meanings. And what he said is when you read, you're actually guessing what the definition of the first word is, and then the second word and the third word, and you're guessing all the way through this. And he said originally, I checked back into Webster's 1828, and sure enough, it was, they said to guess was one of the original definitions of the word read. It was derived in part, but they had others. It wasn't the only one. It was one. Well, this to me goes to the idea of definitions. You know, the government changes the definitions, and by simply changing the definitions, they can change the meaning of law, for example. They can change what's happening in economics just by tinkering with the definitions, or even choosing. If there's three possible definitions and the people think the definition of a particular term is number one, and the government says secretly, they say, no, we'll use number two or maybe number three. It becomes strange. It becomes mystical, practically. How do you communicate if you can't rely on the definitions? It's pretty astonishing, and I don't know if that rings your bell, but it rings mine. It's just, we live in a world, how do you perceive this world if you can't depend on the definitions?
That's such an important point, and one that we generally don't think about. And not to get all philosophical on you, but Ludwig Wittgenstein came up with the formulation, the limits of our language are the limits of our reality. And I think there's a real underlying truth to that, because, again, we are so much wrapped up in language that it can be used to manipulate us if we're not careful.
Absolutely.
And we see that all the time in our daily lives. Of course, the unemployment, just one, unemployment figures is just one example of that. We hear the term unemployment and we think we know what that means. So when we hear X percent are unemployed, we think we have an understanding. But yeah, do we really? There's six different definitions that the government uses. There's U1, the percentage of the labor force unemployed 15 weeks or longer. U2, percentage of labor force who lost jobs or completed temporary work. U3, the official unemployment rate per the ILO definition, occurs when people are without jobs and they have actively looked for work within the past 4 weeks. But then U4 is U3 plus discouraged workers. U5 is U4 plus marginally attached workers. U6 is U5 plus part-time workers who want to work full-time. So again, choose a definition that suits your purposes. I mean, lies, damned lies, and statistics, lies, damned lies, and government definitions of unemployment, pretty much the same thing.
I understand. And it's another illustration of this business about reading is guessing. They have multiple definitions. Which one are they talking about? And depending on which one, what are we talking about? What are we being told? It becomes confusing. You talked about being manipulated by means of a sophisticated use of the language. There's not much doubt that government's ability to manipulate people has grown dramatically. Advertisers' ability to manipulate people has grown dramatically. But at the same time, people's awareness of the fact that they're being manipulated has also grown. So where are we right now? Are we in a world where government, it's easier for government to manipulate us? Or are we in a world where we have become perhaps wise or maybe just cynical and we're not easily manipulated anymore? How's this battle going between the manipulators and the manipulated? Who's winning?
It's a good question, and I would like to think that we are at least capable of winning, but I would say we're at a considerable disadvantage at this point, because although we are becoming more cynical in some senses, unfortunately, we are being played with at our most basic primal psychological levels in ways that the public still only has a very fleeting grasp of, and I think, again, that plays to our disadvantage. So that, for example, I think everyone understands when a beer commercial shows you scantily clad women, they're really just playing on your basic instincts to try to associate that with, you know, drinking beer, and you'll somehow become sort of swarthy Lothario simply by drinking one or another brand of beer. And I think we all understand that as a basic manipulation. And yet it still happens, and it's still fairly effective. In fact, if we saw different types of beer commercials, we might actually wonder what's going on, because that would be so far outside the norm. But I mean, this is the fundamental idea of advertising and what's been refined now for at least a century, which is the idea, of course they don't play on the actual facts, the ingredients, the statistics surrounding any product. What they're playing on is fundamental associations, psychological mm-hmm. base drives, instincts, things of that nature that are very hard for us not to have our buttons pushed when they are pushed in the right way. And I mean, the greatest example of this, of course, was Edward Bernays working in the early part of the last century, the American nephew of Sigmund Freud, who was employed by a number of large American corporations to try to apply psychological tactics on their markets. And one of the famous examples, and one that I always go back to because it was just so, in a way, brilliant, horrific, but brilliant, the American Tobacco Company contracted Edward Bernays to try to find out how to break into the other half of the market that was untappable by tobacco companies at that time, which was women. There was a huge taboo against women smoking at that time, and it was just basically not done in polite society for women to smoke. How do you break a taboo like that? That's not just an aversion to a product. It's actually social. It's a social phenomenon. And Bernays did some research and discovered the psychological associations between cigarettes and male power, and then there was the suffragette movement, and he thought, well, here's a way we can tie it in, and suddenly cigarettes aren't cigarettes, they're torches of liberty. And so he stages an event at the Easter Day Parade in New York City to get some photogenic young women to light up their torches of liberty in the parade route as a protest in pursuit of women's suffragism. And suddenly we have these suffragettes who are now smoking, and then it starts to become a trend, and all of a sudden it becomes a symbol and power of female equality and political equality. And suddenly it's not cigarettes, they're not smoking, they're mm-hmm. protesting. It's a political thing. And by doing that, he breaks the taboo. Within weeks of that campaign, which no one knew at the time was a campaign and that was all staged in photo ops at the Easter Day Parade, but within weeks in New York City, for example, they desegregated the smoking area of cinemas and theaters and things of that sort. So suddenly there was spaces for women to smoke, and women were smoking all across the country. And one of the most disturbing parts of that story, the Easter Day Parade event was staged so these women stop in the parade route and light up their cigarettes as some sort of political movement. But within days, similar protests were taking place around the country that were not staged. Edward Bernays had no part in them. They were happening spontaneously. So he tapped into something so psychologically underlying that it actually started a real social phenomenon. And that's the type of level at which advertisers have been playing on us for at least a century now. And imagine how much more refined that is in this day and age than it was back then. So I'm afraid that if this is an arms race, generally the advertisers are decades ahead of us. And the best that we can do is be aware that we are being constantly manipulated in such ways, and to try to maintain our intellectual independence when it comes to these types of issues.
You know, if the advertisers are way ahead of us on this, and they're able to manipulate us with greater sophistication than most of us can understand, it also follows that the advertisers are doing so because they're selling products. So what happens if we slide into another Great Depression and we are unable to buy products? What happens to our susceptibility to advertising then?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to approach that. One way, of course, is just to say, well, yes, there will obviously be a greatly reduced economic activity, which means that the competition for customers among corporations will be even greater, which will probably mean they'll bring out or try to develop even bigger guns when it comes to trying to convince people to buy their products. But then I think the entire other side of this is that advertising and playing on people's psychology is, of course, not just done by corporations and not just done to sell products. It's, of course, employed by governments and more commonly known as propaganda. Yeah. And I think that's the way that we have to look at at so much of what's happening, and obviously in the event of economic crises, I think one of the major assaults on our psyche will be from the government trying to convince us that it's here to help and it's the one that's going to smooth out the situation. And it's interesting just how much control they have over the optics of so many situations, including things like unemployment and scarcity and people struggling. You know, decades ago, we would have seen soup lines or whatever forming given the amount of suffering there is in the economy, but now it's all automated through food stamp systems. So even though there's more people on food stamps than have ever been in the entire history of the country, well, it's all right because, you know, we don't see it. It's not something that you see, the big lines that you saw back in the Depression era. So out of sight, out of mind. And it's little psychological manipulations like that can, again, completely sway our perception of even the fact that we are or are not in a depression.
You know, people talk about perception being reality. Some people say perception is reality. Well, there's a point to that argument. But aren't there limits to that argument too? Isn't there going to be a point where all of a sudden we're going to have to actually deal with reality and not merely perception? And we're going to face up to the fact that, holy cow, it's not just where the soup lines, maybe we see them, maybe we don't, but maybe the cards don't work anymore that provide us with access to cheap food provided by the government. At what point does perception and reality, when does that finally break down when we're forced to see reality? I think what we'll do is maybe we'll answer that question when we come back. We'll take a break for some commercial announcements. I'm Alfred Addisk here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report. And we will be back on Financial Survival in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk. I'm here on Financial Survival. Our guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, CORBETTREPORT.com, CorbettReport.com. We're talking about the difference between perception is reality. Some people argue that goes to perhaps the idea of political correctness, but perception is reality. And we have another way of looking at it, perception versus reality. Meaning perception, reality is reality and perception is not reality. And we were talking about this a little bit before we broke. And do you have any comment on the conflict between perception is reality as compared to perception versus reality?
Yes, well, there is clearly a line at which our perceptions butt up against reality, and that can be economic reality, military reality, or otherwise. But it is really remarkable, and perhaps something that would surprise a lot of people who've never put any thought into it, how far we can go in making reality with our perceptions, i.e. how far we can actually bring things about in a type of self-fulfilling prophecy. And if people want to think about how that can work in a society, I mean, I think we are basically test lab rats in a great experiment as to how far this can go, as we say, as we talk about things like the unemployment rate and basically government trying to convince us that everything's fine. So people really aren't that concerned, generally speaking. Consumer sentiment is up. They're expecting a record-breaking retail season for Christmas shopping season and all of this. People are acting as if everything's fine. In fact, people are taking on more debt again, exactly like we saw in the run-up to the last bubble pop back in 2008. So worrying for people who are worried about reality. But at the same time, if you want to think about how perceptions can shape reality and can keep people in situations that they otherwise would try to protest against, just think about some of the great works of literature that have tried to warn us about these types of societies. And the two that most people go back to these days, 1984, Brave New World, both examples of totalitarian societies in various ways, although Brave New World, I guess you could argue, wasn't exactly a totalitarian society, such as a completely psychologically controlled society. Yeah. And that's maybe part of the point.
People far more dangerous
in many ways. Yes. The boot on
far
the face.
More dangerous than 1984. In the end, we can deal with people coming at us with rifles and trying to smash our heads in with clubs and the rest of that. And that's since, from my perspective, 1984, they were imposing big government by force. but Brave New World.
But there was an element of that.
They were imposing, governed by a kind of consent and manipulation, and they were here to help us, and everybody fell for it.
That's right. It was much more refined in Brave New World, but there was an element of the psychological control in 1984 as well. Remember the Emmanuel Goldstein character, who may or may not have been real, probably wasn't, who was just someone that they could project their 2 minutes hate onto so that everyone would gather and have 2 minutes of hate and throw things at the screen and rage just seeing, you know, people seeing this figure paraded across a screen. And that was a way of, as a sort of outlet for society to take out their aggression and rage on some, you know, boogeyman figure. And of course, Big Brother, again, just a kind of character that was used to that people were trained to love. And in the end, what happens? Winston ultimately succumbs to the programming and he learns to love Big Brother. So it is a psychological control that's going on in 1984 as well, but obviously much more scientific and much more refined in Brave New World. And thus, I think you're right, much scarier. And I think we are living through that type of experiment. And we don't really even have to go out on a hypothetical limb for that. If you watch some of or listen to some of Aldous Huxley's lectures or interviews in the final years of his life, he spoke quite openly about many of the incredible experiments that he had seen going on at that time, given his access to the scientific world through his brother and his family, of course, a famous British scientific family stretching back to T.H. Huxley, Darwin's bulldog. And they were right there in the thick of this type of experimentation. And he talked about people being wired up with electrodes to their brain to make them feel different types of emotions. And again, this was in the early 1960s, late 1950s. So again, that's 50, 60, 70-year-old technology at this point. Again, imagine how much more refined that can be. And when you start thinking about that, I mean, Brave New World, 1984, I mean, it's not so far off, and in fact, we may be living through aspects of it already, and it's really worrying, because again, as you say, I mean, it's a psychological control that can't be directly opposed as someone with a gun coming at you can. At the very least, I mean, you might live, you might die, but at least you can fight in that situation. But what do you do when they're controlling your mind and your perceptions?
That's the dangerous thing about it, and that's what's frustrating about the world where we live right now. Markets are manipulated. Almost hard to find markets that aren't being manipulated. And we live in a society where we're being manipulated. And you wonder, what would it be like to live in reality? I mean, is this a pleasant dream that I'm caught in right now? Or would I prefer to live in a reality that offered a little more pain, but also a little more legitimate joy or legitimate struggle or something? There's something dishonest about each of our lives if we're going to be manipulated, and I find that disturbing. I don't know that other people do, but I think you understand what I'm talking about.
I do, and again, this is not a new idea. It stretches back thousands of years, and we could think of Plato's cave analogy as one of the early iterations of this. Basically, would you prefer to be one of those people living chained up in the cave watching the shadows on the wall, who's happy enough with your life, or would you prefer to be the person who goes up and discovers there's an actual world outside of the cave and goes in and tries to tell people about it, and they end up attacking him because they don't want to hear about that? I mean, which is the happier person? I think most of us understand that the happier life would be to actually know about the real world, regardless of whether it's a happy place or not. It's better to know and confront and realize reality. But at the same time, it's, again, the illusion can be very tempting, and it can be very easy to just coast through your life living through that illusion. And unfortunately, that seems to be where a lot of our society has decided it wants to spend its time, as the, I don't know, Kardashians, is that still a reference? I'm not sure. Whatever it is the distraction.
I'm not sure either. Are you talking about the three daughters?
I believe I am.
Are you talking about an economist?
Or no. I'm talking about the pop culture.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Yeah, it all comes and goes. Let me move on a little bit here. Alan Greenspan was at the New Orleans Investment Conference last Saturday and quoted, according to this article, if I believe this is last Saturday, Greenspan was quoted. He says, "The gold standard is not possible in a welfare state." You comment on that?
Well,
that's got to be a surprising. Yeah. That's got to be a surprising admission, or at least claim. Can't have a welfare state with a gold standard. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it's an accurate assessment because, again, the welfare state is predicated on the ability of government to print as much money as it wants. And if it is limited in its supply, then it's extremely difficult to do that, which is why I think it's no surprise that we saw in the 1930s with the development of FDR's. It wasn't the Great Society. What was his little propaganda phrase? I don't remember. Whatever way they tried to sell the Social Security.
New Deal.
Yeah, the New Deal, exactly. The New Deal programs came about at the same time as Roosevelt implemented the confiscation of gold, because, again, it was part of that process by which the U.S. economy was delinked from its gold reserve, its gold standard. It didn't ultimately, finally, and completely and formally take place until 1971, but the U.S. was obviously on that road for a very long time, and I think those two things are linked. So we see the growth of government as we see the ability of its of it to create new money expand, and again, that's a pretty basic economic sense, and it's not really surprising that Greenspan would know this. It might be surprising that he would say it, but Greenspan, let's remember, he started out as an Ayn Rand acolyte and someone who wrote about the gold standard and how that was the way that money should be run in a society. He wrote essays about that back in the early 1960s, and then lo and behold, he ends up becoming the chairman of the Fed and overseeing the one of the greatest growth bubbles in history by basically printing money like there's no tomorrow and leading directly to the bubble popping of 2008. So he speaks from knowledge and experience, but it's just perhaps only surprising that he actually said something like that.
Yeah, it's surprising that he has said something like that. And it's, you wonder, has Greenspan simply become old enough where he just says, to heck with it, I'm going to tell the truth? Or does this signal something else? Does it signal that we're on a point where we are about to confront the truth, whether we like it or not? And some people like Greenspan are just saying, look, we can't sustain the illusion any longer. We may as well tell the truth because we can't deny it much longer. You see what I'm saying?
I do. And I think it could be either of those options. It could be a third option. It could be that there is a plan for the manipulation of the growth in gold that is going to take place, some way that the bankers can get ahead of that, and that often happens throughout history. So it shouldn't be surprising if the economic reality is determined, really, that, for example, the price of gold will rise, then the bankers will want to position themselves in a way to get ahead of that. And there may be number of reasons why they would spill some of the beans into some of the people with a wink and a nod. I'm just reading from one of the articles covering Greenspan's comments, and not only did he talk about the gold in the welfare state, but the question was actually posed to him, where will the price of gold be in 5 years?
Yep.
And he said higher. They asked how much, and he says measurably. So, again, I mean, I think you're right. It is going up, and I think everyone who understands that knows what's going to happen to the price of gold. But again, it's a question of who gets positioned in that, and the banks have and the bankers have generally had the gold markets, if not cornered, at least greatly controlled. Most of the gold in the world is held by governments and big banks, so they're perhaps the ones who are best situated to actually profit from this when it happens, because so much of our economy has been delinked from precious metals that very few people have it in even small amounts in their retirement nest egg.
You talk about the government to some degree being delinked from gold. There are reports, speculative, from some people who believe that the government may have sold or leased all of the gold that was formerly in the United States Treasury. Maybe it's all gone. Do you think that's possible? Do you think it's a true story? And if it is, does it preclude the idea that we'll ever have another gold-based currency in this country? How can we have a gold-based dollar, for example? Could we go back to a gold-based dollar if we don't have any gold in our treasury?
Well, those are all good points. First of all, is it possible? It certainly is. And I would say it's even probable that there is no gold at Fort Knox. If there mm-hmm. was, why wouldn't they audit it? They haven't audited in decades. I mean, I think there's a reason. The last public audit was 1953. So where there's smoke, there's fire. And I think we have to assume at this point that the Treasury does not hold the gold that it claims to hold. But it raises an interesting question, which is, I mean, Even if we did go to a gold standard, which I don't actually advocate for a number of reasons, I think it really puts shackles on the economy that don't need to be there. But even if we did go to a gold standard, the question is, what is gold in this day and age? Because we treat the paper gold that circulates out there and the promises of gold and these certificates that say that gold exists somewhere as gold itself, and those get traded around and they get leased out and derivatives get created from them, and all of this other paper phony funny money games get played with it, that unless it goes to the actual, I mean, real physical held gold that is publicly audited on a regular basis, how could you trust, again, the governments to simply provide the information realistically and in a transparent way about how much gold they even have, let alone where it is and how it's being taken care of? So, I mean, there's so many different manipulations that could take place, even if there was a gold standard implemented, that I think we have to be wary of those types of solutions posed for the crises that, again, have been created by the banks themselves.
Which brings us back. We are pretty close to full circle from where we started this program, this interview. We started talking about the difference between appearance and reality. And when we start talking about whether we have paper gold or physical gold and all the rest of manipulations, that goes right back to that fundamental subject. Gold, in the end, is real. All the pieces of paper, to me, are just illusory. Gold is real if you can find it, if you can count it, if you can stack it. Okay, that's real. The rest of it's an illusion. Can we live in that illusory world for much longer? How much longer can we survive? And we've got about a minute before we run out of time, James.
Well, obviously, I can't give a date and time, but I can say that money essentially is trust. And they have been playing on that trust, the belief, the faith in the government's idea that this is redeemable in some way, if not now for gold, at least in some way that the Treasury is backing up these notes that are being put out there into the economy. As long as that trust remains, as long as people believe that the government is good for its promises, then people will generally support the monetary system. And when that trust collapses is the point at which the monetary system collapses. And as always, it's just a question of what they bring in to replace that system. So are you going to trust the same people who created the problem to fix it? I personally am not, which is why I'm already preparing for the inevitable collapse.
I agree. I think probably I am, and most of the people listening to this program are doing the same. I want to thank you again for being on the program, James. I always enjoy talking to you on the program. Always insightful and intelligent answers, and I'm sure the listeners appreciate them as I do. Thank you. We're out of time, folks. I want to thank all of you for listening. I will be back with Melody tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, and James Corbett. Good night.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay.